Hello, and welcome to
Killing It
on Broadway. I'm Jennifer Simard.
And I am Jessica Vosk.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jennifer.
And hi, Betty Buckley and Norman Buckley. Welcome.
Hi. Hi, Jennifer. Hi, Jessica.
Yes, welcome. Welcome to our podcast where we have our friends from their home state come on and discuss a true crime. This one is, I think, very, very poignant and special to the guests that we have on today, wouldn't you say, Jen?
Yes, and I want to welcome them and I want to welcome our listeners. This week, we are diving into a case from Fort Worth, Texas, and we are so lucky to have Tony Award winner Betty Buckley here with us, as Texas is her home state. But today is a little bit different because we also have Betty's brother Norman with us, director and producer in his own right, and he plays a very personal role or has a personal connection to this particular case we are about to discuss. But before we get into that, Betty, Norman, you both are successful individuals with inspiring careers. But the thing about our show is we don't like to talk about that whatsoever. We don't like to talk about our careers. I hope that's okay.
Well,
we hope that's all right. Now, Jen and I have created this podcast because we are here to talk true crime, and we ask our guests, we are wondering, especially for the two of you, if you have any general interest in true crime, if you grew up enjoying true crime. If so, when did your fascination with it start? Like us, I've been so obsessed with true crime for so many years. I wanted to become a lawyer for a long time. So I've been on a deep dive of novels and documentaries and podcasts for years. And we always ask when you became intrigued and why you think creative types like us are so interested in true crime.
Go ahead, Norm.
Well, I think that there is a interest in the idea of evil that comes early in one's life. And I think for me, probably the first time I was really aware of something horrible and truly unspeakable evil was when the 9 student nurses were murdered in Chicago.
Richard Speck, is that right?
I remember that very clearly. And I was probably 10 or 11 years old when that happened. And so that was always something that kind of suggested that there was this world of evil out there that I think one learns to psychically protect oneself against. Mm. And then I was also growing up fascinated by Agatha Christie novels, death in the parlor type of mystery as well. So I do think that there is something about it that just is intrinsic to being a human being, not just creative types, but any human being learning to trust one's intuition and to really guard oneself against that evil that does exist in the world. I also believe that there's probably something in the shows that I've worked on. There's a lot of mystery often. I've worked on a lot of procedurals. I've shot a lot of murder scenes, you know, so I think that it's something that certainly is appealing to creative types as well. Obviously, there's a hunger for it. Procedurals will always be with us, I think, in terms of television viewing. I don't know.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Agreed.
For sure.
What about you,
Betty?
Miss Betty.
So I've always been interested in the psychological aspects of why people do what they do. And my favorite novels to read are police procedural, you know, crime novels. Like, my favorite writer is Michael Connelly. So, and I just have his brand new book, and I've read all of his books. He describes the world of the LA Police Department so well and how they go about solving crimes. I've also, my whole life, been interested in working for the FBI. In fact, recently, I started fantasizing about that again, wondering if I was too old. And then I thought, probably I'm too old to go through the training. Then I thought, maybe not. Maybe I could do it. But I just think I would be really good at that, like infiltrating.
Oh, Betty, you would be. And I have to say, I just talked about this recently. I'm going to look it up and tell the age to our listeners. Or maybe, hey, Smokey, could you look up the age and text it to me? Because to be an FBI agent, there is, in fact, a cutoff date. It's rather young. I want to say 35. And I was so disappointed, Betty, because I'm with you, sis. I was like, I want to do this. And I was like, nope. Aged out. Jessica, you might be just on the cusp. I don't know. We have to look at it.
You know what? I'm already aged out, but now thank you for the reminder. I definitely, I'm 37, and I would not be able to to become an FBI agent. But boy, boy, do I understand the fascination, Betty, with the psychological aspects of why somebody does the things they do. Or Norman, you said before, going back to childhood, you know, how are all these things connected? Like, I don't know, I find something so intriguing sociologically and psychologically all the time about, you know, why does somebody, we say, couldn't you have just gotten a divorce?
Right.
Why'd you have to do the other thing? Yeah. You know, why'd you have to go kill the family?
Right.
I mean, it's a really, I really connect to what you just said about understanding somebody. And of course, I really think that we should make an exception and make Miss Betty Buckley an FBI agent, an honorary
or the CIA.
FBI agent.
I think I could be a good spy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, I would. I back you all the way, my friend.
My brother is laughing. Stop laughing at me, Norman. Well, I knew we would run into this problem if you were on this podcast with us.
I just don't think that you would be a good CIA agent.
Norman, you're so wrong. You're always wrong. You have no idea who I am as a person. You assume you do, but you don't.
I just am afraid that the secrets wouldn't stay safe.
Norman, that is so wrong.
This is the thing. You guys have now set a bar where we're going to need to have siblings on every show.
Yep, that's right. I have now, this is my new favorite episode.
Yeah,
without a doubt.
Listeners, you can't see this, but Jessica and I, whenever we love something, like the hands go in the air, like we're at a football game.
It's a touchdown.
Yeah.
It's a touchdown moment.
And just as my friend, Betty, I have to tell you, I'm taking a forensic psychology class and I took criminology last semester to make use of this time. Yeah, so if I can do it, you can do it. You can do it. You can be an FBI agent.
Thank you. See, Norman.
Here we go. I got the answer from Smokey. Both veterans, Jessica, you're going to love this. Both veterans and Bureau employees can apply for a waiver to the 37 years of age limit for most applicants. Current FBI employees can apply prior to their 39th birthday if they can be appointed and assigned prior to their month of their 40th birthday. So Jessica, do it for all of us. Okay.
All right. I'll take one for the team. I will gladly take one for the team.
All right. So moving on to this case, and we're going to try to handle this as delicately as possible. As we always try to say, these are real people and we don't take that lightly. Now, as many of our podcast listeners know, we've covered cases that are still unsolved, all the way to cold cases being reinvestigated, all the way up to murders solved almost instantaneously. This case has haunted friends and family for over 46 years. And just this month, the suspected killer has been indicted by a grand jury on a capital murder charge. So first, credit where credit is due. We got some of our information for today's episode from Inside Edition, Oxygen, MamaMia.com, Dallas News, and the Star Telegram. We thank all of them for their reporting. This is the case of Carla Walker. The brutal murder of high school cheerleader Carla Walker haunted Texans in the 1970s. According to many of those who knew her, Carla was a beautiful spirit inside and out, so young and full of life. And we must say, after researching this case and seeing many photos of Carla, she is just the most beautiful young woman with a sparkle about her. Her sister has even referred to her as a little spitfire in many interviews along the 46-year quest to find her killer. At the time, Carla, age 17, was dating football quarterback Rodney McCoy, who went to the same high school as her in Fort Worth, Western Hills High School in Benbrook, a suburb on the south side of Fort Worth, to be exact. And I'd like to pause here because, Norman, prior to recording, you were saying that she actually wasn't a cheerleader as described, and I'd like you to expand on that. And you went to not only high school, but junior high with her. And this is someone you knew. So I'd like you to tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I've seen in the news accounts that she's referred to as a cheerleader. I think she was in the Spirit Club, and I definitely think she ran in that group of girls that were cheerleaders. But I don't remember Carla being a cheerleader. I'm pretty sure about that. Yes, I knew her from the time that I was in seventh grade. The year I went into seventh grade, they changed the structure of the middle school so that middle school included sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. And Carla was in sixth grade and I was in seventh. So I knew her from the time that she was in sixth grade on. And then I was a senior in high school. She was a junior. Rodney was in my class. And so, yeah, I was there at the Valentine's Day dance the last night that anybody saw her.
Wow.
We're going to get more to the dance. And I think it's in the section Jessica's going to kind of bring up.
It is. Yeah. We're heading on to that section next.
But Rodney McCoy, as you said, was in your class. Yeah, he was a senior, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. He was starting quarterback for the Western Hills Cougars football team. And Carla's sister has said that the couple had a great relationship and they didn't fight, that it was a nice relationship. Jessica?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now here we get to what we had just discussed with Norman, which is the night of February 16th, 1974. So Carla and Rodney were on a date when she was abducted from a parking lot in Fort Worth, Texas. And on the night of the abduction, Walker and McCoy attended a Valentine's Day dance. And afterward, they partied with friends and later stopped by a local bowling alley to use the restrooms. And after having used the restroom, they'd returned to the car and... boom, they were attacked in the parking lot of the bowling alley, which according to McCoy, he was beaten unconscious. And when he came to, Walker was gone. So, Norman, you were at this dance.
I was at the dance, yeah.
Which blows my mind. It just blows my mind.
Yeah, it's...
Did we get anything wrong to your estimation so far?
I think that somebody asked me recently, I was interviewed by the Star Telegram, you know, where I was when I found out. And it's hard to remember, number one, it's 46 years ago, but also because she was missing for 2 days. I think that she was missing from Saturday night. And I think, as I remember, and maybe you guys know the answer to this, but I don't think they found her body until Wednesday. I think, as I remember, that when they did find her, I feel that I found out at school, but it's, again, it's been 46 years. It's hard to remember exactly the details of who communicated what. My next door neighbor, a woman named Patty Montague, she was very close friends with Carla. So I think that I probably found out from Patty that she was missing because the Sunday after the dance, you know, the word was going around from one person to another. And so I feel fairly certain I found out from Patty.
Wow. Well, when police and other media had talked to Rodney McCoy, he said, quote, "She was such a sweet girl. I remember we were in the front seat of the car. Her back was against the passenger door and she was falling out. I went to grab her and he started beating me over the head with a pistol." End quote. And in 2017, Carla's sister recounted the evening like it was yesterday, saying she remembered a relentless banging on her front door, which told her something was wrong. Quote, "McCoy had blood just streaming down his face, screaming, 'They got her, they got her, they took her.'" Mm-hmm. And as we just discussed, as Norman just mentioned, Carla's body was discovered on February 20th, 1974, in a culvert beneath a rural road south of Fort Worth. Her clothes were ripped, and she had been strangled to death. Now, police said Walker had been beaten and sexually assaulted before she was murdered, and morphine was found in her system. Now, at this point, what Rodney could do is give the police a description of the man who had abducted Carla. So he said white, average height, slender, clean cut. They also had a clue right off the bat, which was found in the parking lot of the bowling alley, a magazine for a .22 Ruger pistol lying next to Carla's purse. McCoy told investigators that the assailant stuck the gun in his face and pulled the trigger repeatedly, but it didn't go off.
Wow.
McCoy, isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
McCoy recalls Walker screaming, "Go get my dad," as he slipped into unconsciousness. And when he came to, that's when he went to Walker's home and the police were immediately notified.
The girl yelled, "Go get my dad."
She did, according
to her
boyfriend.
Yeah, because I was wondering and reading about all this, why, I guess he was just completely out of it. But, and this was obviously pre-cell phone, but why he didn't go find a policeman. That was interesting to me.
Yeah.
Well, Carla's house was like just a very short distance from the bowling alley. It's, you know, my tendency would be to have gone right to her house as well. It wasn't far. You know, the bowling alley was on the west side of Fort Worth. It's a small area. It's a small geographic area where all these events took place. It wasn't like you had to drive 10 miles to get to her house. It was less than probably a half mile.
And I'm guessing this all happened pretty fast. I'm guessing that Rodney McCoy was beaten unconscious pretty fast before. I mean, again, this is my speculation in reading about this case and hearing all of what he has had to say, because I'm sure that there's a bit of guilt associated with this whole situation as well.
I feel for Rodney a great deal, because there was also a lot of people who tried to cast suspicion upon him. I mean, he was a good guy who really cared for her a lot, and he's had to carry this for all these years. I mean, my heart goes out to Rodney. just having everything stirred up now.
Absolutely.
He also said that his description of the guy was really, like, he says, clean cut, slender young man, about 20, with short cropped wavy hair, who talked with a Texas drawl and stood about 5'11" inches, wearing a shiny green sleeveless vest and a near white cowboy hat. So he, wow. That's a very specific description too.
Which
yeah, incredibly so.
I mean, the guy was 32 at the time, but I think that his description of him proved to be very accurate.
And Betty Lynn, were you in New York at this time? Where were you in?
It was 1974. Is that what?
Yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would have been.
You were in New York. I think you would have been doing Pippin by that point, wouldn't you? I remember that because I went to visit Betty Lynn. I want to say it was right after my senior year in the summer while she was still doing Pippin.
Mm-hmm. So wow.
It might have been the summer before my senior year. I can't remember for sure.
Right. Well, at this point of the story, we're going to discuss cold case investigator Paul Holes. And remember his name. He plays a very important role in this case, and we'll get to him in a bit. But Paul Holes said Walker's murder could be a sexually motivated homicide that was predatory in nature and not unlike those committed by serial killers, which now brings us to a few suspects they had at the time of the murder. Detective Leah Wagner of the Fort Worth Police Department has been very clear that one suspect was Tommy Ray Neyland. In April 1974, Neyland abducted a teenage girl in nearby Arlington and tried to sexually assault her, but she escaped. Which is wonderful. I'm glad she escaped. Neyland was identified by his victim, and he subsequently confessed to 3 murders, 2 of which occurred in Fort Worth. He was sentenced to life in prison, but he was paroled in 1987. He returned to custody, however, after violating the terms of his parole. They still could now attach him personally to Walker's murder. In 1977, a man called Jimmy Sasser confessed to murdering Carla and was charged. Months later, he admitted that his confession was false, made when he was depressed over his marriage breakup. The charges.
Again, I'm sorry. I'm just going to say, sir. No.
I know it happens. Sir. People do that.
They do that. I'm just saying that's another one of those psychological things where you go, oh, you got into a horrible fight with your significant other. Somebody forgot to make dinner. And now I'm going to confess. I'm going to falsely confess to a murder and almost this close to ruining his life. Sorry, to interject it. It blows my mind.
No, you're a very passionate person, and
I am. I talk with my hands. I'm Italian. Sorry. Okay. Go
ahead. The charges, obviously, because this was not true, they were subsequently dropped. Next up, the police questioned a man by the name of Glenn McCurley. Now, Glenn McCurley lived near the bowling alley and had bought a .22 Ruger pistol. He had won previous arrests for car theft. He was off work on the day that Carla was abducted, and his wife was out of town. But there was simply nothing else to link him to the crime. At the time, as we have discussed before on this podcast, DNA evidence in the 1970s was just not what it is now. And the investigators were not able to take any evidence from the crime scene to compare it with samples of someone else's DNA. And I just want to take a moment to discuss something very personal to this case now. Carla Walker's brother, Jim. He had been tirelessly determined over the years to solve the murder of his sister. After both parents passed, his promise on the deathbed of his mother was that he would not give up until Carla's murder was solved. At the time of the case, when he was just a teenager, Jim drove his 3/4-ton Silverado pickup to the Ridgely Bowl parking lot, turned off the headlights, and waited for hours. At Benbrook Lake, he wandered through the woods of Holiday Park and camped in a culvert near the water, all the while hoping to find the man who murdered his sister. This particular murder really tested the town and its community. Norman, you were quoted in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram as saying, quote, the city kind of ended in our neighborhoods, end quote. Would you elaborate on your feeling at the time and the almost immediate change that was felt in the community?
Well, we lived right on the edge of town. When we moved to the house where I grew up, there was a block and then just open fields. It was the very edge of town. And so there was this quality about it that was half rural, half urban, but it was a small community. Most of the people who lived in our neighborhood were children of employees of General Dynamics, which was the defense factory. That was the employer. Most everybody was of the same socioeconomic level. We all knew each other. We'd all grown up together, and my elementary school fed into the junior high. The high school that we went to was a brand new high school. So there was this almost, I want to say, it felt like a small town on the west side of Fort Worth, and nobody locked their doors. Nobody worried about this other thing coming in that, as I said, when I was talking about the Chicago student nurses, that felt like a world away. Mm. It felt like evil happened other places and other cities. So for me, I think that, and a lot of my classmates I know feel the same way, the abduction and murder of Carla was the first immediate experience we had of something really horrible entering our world. And it made everything after that feel different. I don't think just for myself, but for many of my classmates. And we've talked about it for the 46 years that have elapsed. Wow. And something that's haunted a lot of us. A lot of people I know were involved in a podcast that was specifically about trying to figure out this case. And I think it was weirdly serendipitous that I came back to visit my mother. I've been here for several weeks visiting my mother during this pandemic. And the case was solved as soon as I got back to town.
Wow.
It was weirdly serendipitous. I just thought, wow, after all this time, they finally have found this guy.
Well, and I'm that feeling of your small town safety being ripped away in a very fast and scary way is something, even when I think about a bowling alley. God, I loved a bowling alley. I still love a bowling alley. But I loved that. I loved going roller skating. I loved, you know, at the time of not having a cell phone, being dropped off by my parents and them saying, we'll pick you up at this time, be outside on the curb. And, you know, I grew up small town New Jersey, but I know that feeling. And I wanted to volley it over to you, Betty, because I'm wondering, when you heard about this case, when, you know, do you remember where you were when you heard about it? Have, you know, subsequently over the years, is it something that you took a lot of interest in as well from it being in your hometown?
No, I was never really, there's a whole bunch of years that I really wasn't in contact with my folks and things that were going on back home. We had a real rift in our relationship. So I didn't really come into awareness of the case until very recently when I found out that it had been solved. And Norman, I remember that a schoolmate of Norman's was killed, but I didn't know the specifics.
Well, now that we're sort of changing gears and we told our listeners that we were going to get back to this guy named Paul Holes, and here we are. Holes was, for all intents and purposes, a famous detective with his own television show and happened to be one of the people who cracked the case of the Golden State Killer. And it was around...
What's the name of that show on HBO, the Patton Oswalt? Michelle Magnemar.
Yes, that
show, All Begun in the Dark, was amazing in terms of the way that they solved that and the DNA evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really fascinating.
Yeah, it's I just finished that documentary, and you're right. Who knew genealogy when we discussed it earlier, and you know, samples of DNA really put everything together. And I when you said serendipitously, I feel like that documentary, for anybody who hasn't watched yet, ends very serendipitously because we lost Michelle McNamara. However, the case happened to be solved. And I think she had something to do with it up there.
This episode is brought to you by our best friends at Spindrift. Yes, you heard me, best friends. For those who know us, you know how addicted we are to true crime and sparkling water. Cue the day when we were both starring in Broadway shows and stumbled upon the Holy Grail, Spindrift.
America's first sparkling water with real squeezed fruit. Yep, that's it. 11 flavors with no worries about any chemicals going into your body. You'll have a crush on all flavors, trust us.
Oh, and they make the perfect mixer for your holiday bevies too. Ugh, the possibilities are endless. Just go now to drinkspindrift.com, find your match, and use our sassy sparkling code KILLIT20 at checkout and get 20% off your first order. Self-care, baby. After all, it's necessary in 2020.
But now, heading back to around the time where Paul Holes came back into this was 2018. And Carla's case picked up speed again through both Carla's brother Jim's connections and a few podcasts, which we talked about, which dug into a lot of questions, a lot of missing pieces. And this got Carla's friends and acquaintances talking about the case again, like never before. I think a lot of it had to do with that podcast, right, Norman?
Yes, wouldn't that's right.
Mm-hmm. And Holes, Paul Holes, specifically aired an episode dedicated to Carla in April. And Fort Worth police detectives Leah Wagner and Jay Bennett, who had recently reopened this case, interviewed dozens of witnesses and friends for the first time since 1974. And they struck a deal with Holes. They gave him access to various police files, which Betty would and myself would love access as FBI agents in training to various police files. And his show paid for all of this advanced DNA testing, which happened to be a game changer. So in all of this, DNA analysis uncovered male DNA from three stains on Carla's clothing that had never been successfully read before. Now, the milestone of this was followed by a slight disappointment when the DNA profile didn't link anyone to OnCODIS, which is a law enforcement database that features the DNA of millions of offenders. Now, Hull's next step was to try to go to a separate lab that could create a genealogical profile. He provided the highest quality DNA sample available, but the lab, which he has declined to name, failed in his efforts. But he didn't give up, however, and he was able to find another genealogy lab to match this very minuscule sample. Now get this. It led to three brothers with the last name McCurley. So yes, listeners, remember those suspects from earlier that we were talking about? Glenn McCurley, our third suspect, the one who bought the .22 Ruger pistol. Well, on April 3rd of 1974, according to an affidavit, he told detectives his Ruger had been stolen 6 weeks before, around the same time of Carla's murder. He also explained his wife was out of town and that he was not working on the night of February 16th or at any time on February 17th. However, the police took no further action until the summer of 2020, this summer, which is wild to me. But now this next part feels very Forensic Files, but the new investigators on the case collected discarded items from a trash bin on McCurley's curb. And the DNA tests from the trash arrived in early September of this year and matched the profile from Carla's clothing. From there, police interviewed McCurley, who agreed to give a DNA sample from his mouth, which also matched the DNA found on Carla's clothes, according to an affidavit. The police now had the man they believe killed Carla Walker. McCurley was arrested without incident on September 21st, 2020, and police also recovered the Ruger that McCurley claimed was stolen in 1974. His DNA has not been linked to any other murders, which led investigators to believe that he just went on living a very normal life in Fort Worth, in West Fort Worth, which that's the part that terrifies me the most.
It's mind-boggling.
Like, right?
It was just one. It's like, what? Oh, my God. All these years, you know?
Well, not only that, but I think that he moved his family closer to the bowling alley, which is really one of the things that just freaks me out, is that he lived about a mile and a half, I think, from the bowling alley originally, but then moved to a street that's just right in the vicinity of the bowling alley. And his property backed up to the property of a woman who was on a double date with Carla and Rodney the night of the Valentine's Day dance.
My God.
And, so this girl who was Carla's friend knew him, had disputes with him about things in his backyard that backed up to her backyard all these years. This family continued to go to their church. Melanie Clapp, who is several years younger than me, she knew McCurley's son. She remembers the McCurleys coming to the football games when she was a cheerleader, and that they were just this kind of model family supporting the kids. It just really is an illustration of the banality of evil, that someone that you know could be someone who does something horrible. The thing that I've never been able to figure out in all of this is the morphine. Like, why was there morphine in her system? Why would he have morphine? And how did it end up in her system? And why? That's the part of the story that's just completely perplexing.
Yeah, I would say so as well. I thought to myself, I wonder if it was some, if obviously she was drugged after he took her into his car. You know, obviously, as we get to this next, he's not really talking. He's not giving many interviews about, you know, the situation or what occurred. But I also think to myself, what a mind twister to have to be in that community or to be the neighbor that lives behind him. And you're having arguments about like, you have wood. It happens to be on my property. Get it off my property. Mm-hmm. Who knew that he, this entire, all of these years with a family in tow, which reminds me again of, you know, the Golden State Killer of, you know, having children. Mm-hmm. And
BTK,
living a life.
BTK had a daughter and he went dormant for a long time, but he's right there.
They're at church and they're at the picnics and they're at the gatherings and they're at the football games and you just don't know. And I think
I'd like to know more about the psychological profile. And I'd also like to know how his family functioned, to what degree there was abuse or dysfunction in that family. I'd really like to know more about that, because from what I've read, he tried to pawn it off on the boyfriend, saying that the boyfriend was beating the girl. And so he helped her and the girl was grateful and said she would go with him just not to kill the boyfriend, and that she hugged him and he misread that.
That's right.
Got out of hand. But I just like, what is that psychology that permits that? And then,
well, on some level, it's clear that he tried to justify the event to himself. I mean, it's puzzling to me. I mean, number one, I don't believe any of that he said. I think that he's basically a fantasist at this point. But the part that's so perplexing is that even if you went with some version of that narrative, why does he have morphine? And why would he like inject her with morphine? The whole thing just sounds like a crock of shit. But,
it does sound like a crock of shit, but I don't. I think he, like, to your point, Betty, I think he does believe it himself, or I think he must have believed it, or at least fed himself the narrative.
Is that just like this, you know, like improvising on the spot, coming up with a story to make yourself look good? And to the presence of the morphine implies premeditation, too, right?
It sure does. Yeah,
went there knowing that there was going to be a dance and looking for an opportunity to kidnap a girl or whatever, and having done it once, it's just, to me, I've never even thought of it as fantasy as much as these people make this shit up, thinking you're going to buy it as just liars.
Yeah. But do you think after a while he believes it himself? Like after like 46 years, do you think that he, every single time he would think about it, said, oh, well, she was looking, she needed my help at that time. Yeah. I guess I wonder if there's a way that he justifies it to himself or has justified it to himself while knowing that it's BS.
Right.
I mean, I've done that probably many times at auditions. Like, Jess, you just nailed it. Certainly not. but I tell myself.
Can I just point out, as your companion FBI agent, that's a little different.
You're right. It's 100% different in every single way. But I am obsessed with the psychology of it, too. I really am. I guess I just wonder if we talk oftentimes, Jen and I, about slicing into someone's brain and seeing the different, now that Jen is taking all of these fantastic classes in criminology and forensics, to see someone's brain who is a sociopath or a psychopath or a serial killer, and to see the differences in serotonin.
And as far as what we were talking about before, that people often talk with self-serving bias to get out of wrongdoing, right? They, you know, you always want to come off as better. And like Jess was saying, this McCurley fella, he still declines to give any interviews from jail. He's only spoken publicly once, saying he was drinking in the Ridgely Bowling parking lot and heard an argument, as Betty was saying, between, you know, putting it off on them, between this teenage boy and this girl. And Betty, you're absolutely, that is what he said. I didn't mean to do it. I mistook her for something else. She just gave me a hug and a kiss, just, you know, euphemizing it, making it sound like it was no big deal. Jim Walker has gone on the record saying he forgives McCurley, something that has got to take utmost strength and bravery of spirit. In an interview with CBS Dallas Fort Worth, Jim stated, quote, "The word that came across my brain was finally, finally, this is a resolution that's been prayed for," end quote. And as we said earlier, McCurley is facing capital murder charges and he remains behind bars on $100,000 bond. We are so relieved to see the friends and family of Carla Walker hopefully find some peace 46 years later. And to that, I guess I actually want to know, Norman, I know you can't speak for your friends, but speaking for yourself, having just come home during this global pandemic and having all of this happen from this 46-year journey, what did you feel when?
Well, I think that I can speak for my friends because I've talked to a lot of them since right. this happened. You know, it's kind of it's been one of these things that has haunted all of us throughout our adult lives because we did know her and did love her, and also as I indicated, you know, her family as well. I remember all of these events very, very well, and it's been something that has really left us all with a sense of a lack of closure, a real lack of closure. And certainly seeing the killer come to hopefully some kind of justice is certainly satisfying. But I do think too that it leaves you with this sense of like, okay, so they found him and there's still all these questions that will never really be answered. And that's the thing that I think is so difficult about life, is that you have to really make your peace with not knowing. You know, there are horrible things happen to people, and there is, you know, I'm a big believer in dissociative identity disorders. I do think that people really have traumas in their life. So as my sister said, I think that, you know, I wonder what happened in this guy's life that caused him to be able to be capable of this, apart from the brain chemicals and apart from the genetic coding. Just what events, you know, might have precipitated this kind of dissociation. Because, you know, if indeed he never did it again, which I question, I wonder about, you know, who knows? But okay, let's say it was a one-off thing. You know, how do you live with that and then go move your family closer to the bowling alley? If there's something, you know, if it really was something that was just a mistake, an accident, it seems to me you'd move to the other side of town, you'd move to another state. You wouldn't like say, hey, let's all move closer to the locale where I did this thing.
You know? Absolutely.
And unless you're trying to relive it or something.
Yeah. You so, know? You know, there's a part of me that really wonders just what is going on in that person's inner life. And the answer to that is, we'll never know. You know, we'll never know what that is. It's impossible to know.
Well, maybe we could all show up to the Fort Worth jail and sit him down, see if he'll like talk to all of us and we can get
you to, speak my language.
We get to
what
the
do
answer.
You speak? Yes. You say yes. The things that I think, and are you and any of your friends, however long you're going to be staying where you are, you know, are you getting information on the trial? Are you going to keep following this, or even, you know, I don't know if it's going to be a public capital murder trial. Is there any discussion of anyone, you know, participating or going to the actual trial itself?
Well, I think a lot of my friends, particularly those that were very close with Carla, as I said, the girl who grew up next door to me was a very close friend of Carla's, and a couple of other women that I know well were her posse, so to speak.
Sure.
I think a lot of them just feel a certain degree of relief and wanting to let it go now. I can't speak for them relative to how they're going to follow the trial. Of course, I'll be interested in hearing what happens and what comes down in the trial. But I do think that amongst the people that I was in school with, the general feeling is one of relief for Rodney, relief for Carla's family, what's left of them. I think she only has a sister and brother who's still survivor. I know her sister, and you know, my heart just really goes out to them, and I'm grateful for them that the whole thing has come to some type of closure so that they can just get on with their life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we should let you have the last word on this, Norman, because it affected you personally. And I'm really, really grateful that you trusted us today.
Thanks to my sister for, you know, bringing me into it.
Yes, really. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Yeah, Betty, thank you for diving in. It's really something when people say yes. We call them the OG, the original people that said yes, and you're in season one. And I think you know the esteem with which we hold you, and we love you dearly. And it's really nice to see your face.
Thank you. It's great to see you guys. It's something I'd really like to know how y'all got together and decided that this was the nature of the podcast you wanted to do. That's like a really interesting
story. Jen, why don't we tell her? It's weirdly organic because the two of us have, at least on our social media, often said this to people, like, why am I so intrigued and obsessed with true crime? Like, am I the Zodiac killer? I mean, how did I become so obsessed with this? And Jen posted something on Instagram. What was it, Jen? A question.
Yeah, I had written something that was related to this field, and I was going back to rewrite it. And all of a sudden, I realized, I think that's what I want to do. So I was setting out to do a podcast on my own. And then I decided to do a soft poll on Instagram one night saying, hey, theater folk, how many of you are interested in true crime? Give me a thumbs up back if yes. Jess not only gave me a thumbs up back, she writes back in all caps, all day, every day, in this, you know, all day, every day. And so it was the middle of the night. I had written a pitch for the idea of the show. And then I couldn't sleep. It was 2 a.m. and I thought, oh, and Betty, honestly, our friendship sort of developed in the way ours did, a mutual admiration society, respect of talent and heart and soul and mind. And so I said, you know, we are really simpatico. We have a very similar sensibility. And I thought, I'm going to invite her to do it with me. So I did. And she said yes. And that's how it started.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's become really amazing to see how balanced it is, and that, you know, when you find a good relationship with anyone, whether it be a friendship, business partnership, romantically, how the two of you balance each other, and it's doing really well. And it's because of people like you who say yes to coming on and give your time.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
That's what I was thinking.
So cool. Well, it's great to see you, ladies.
Well, you're so cool.
I just want to say, I just think the two of you are so wonderful. And,
Thank you.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate this today. And
it's been really fun. I guess fun is a strange word to use, but yeah, it's been really nice to be included. So thank you. Thank you, Betty Lynn, for making it happen.
Yeah, Norman. It's good to see you. I haven't seen you in a couple of weeks.
I know.
Pandemic.
What are you doing on for Thanksgiving, the two of you? Are you?
We're hopeful.
We were discussing yesterday about my brother Patrick and his wife wanted to have us over, but we were discussing the whys and wherefores of how that would work, and just trying to be safe. You know, my major concern is just making sure my 95-year-old mother stays healthy. And
absolutely.
Well, ourselves as well. I want to stay healthy as well. But, but you know, I do get very nervous about her exposure to anything until this vaccine comes through. And so we're still trying to work that out.
Masks and trying to figure out the whole logistics.
I feel maybe I'm a long lost member of your family. is an FBI agent after my own heart.
All right. Well, Norman, I feel like you're famous to me because I've just, you know, known Betty now for a few years. I'm so excited to meet you. As Jessica said, we are so grateful for the both of you. And Betty, we love you so, so much. And I miss you. And I'm just, what a tease to see you on this little screen.
Oh, I love you too. I was so blessed during my Hello Dolly rehearsals in New York. The apartment building right across the street from Jennifer.
Yeah.
And so I was like always looking out my window, like, I wonder if I could see her apartment.
Remember?
So we went to that corner restaurant, that Italian restaurant for dinner.
And
she brought me these beautiful socks that I still love to wear that have naughty words on them. Anyway, it was really.
And we watched your season finale of Preacher together.
Yeah,
we did.
Yeah, I invited you there. It was fun.
Aww. Well, we're going to come visit you yet on the ranch when we can all travel again.
I'm a good horseback riding teacher.
Oh, man.
Excellent. All right. Thank you, y'all. Love you.
Thank you.
Bye. Love you.
Thank you so much.
Bye. Bye, Norman.
Bye. Jessica, we need to have siblings from now on.
I feel as though we have, as you said, set the bar where now the only way to do it is have siblings come on. They have maybe a little, you know, a playful fighting moment. Mm-hmm. And And I think it really, it's a bookend. It brings us, mm-hmm. it brings us joy in this holiday season.
Yeah. And if they don't have a sibling, we can trade off being their siblings.
Like, I would,
I think you'd be very good as a sibling for hire. I think you'd be great at that.
I think I would be wonderful because I, while I do have a younger brother, I've never obviously had a sister.
Mm-hmm. I have two older brothers. I don't have a sister. And maybe that's why we have a love match.
I think that might be actually very spot on, my friend.
Kind of. Right? Love and fight this, like sisters a little. Like,
this could know. Be a, this is a spot on
yeah.
moment.
Yeah.
Wow. Everybody listening, you've witnessed with your ears, with your ear holes, the love moment that we've right. just realized. Fred, honestly.
Well,
honestly,
and Fred. Everyone have a very happy and safe Thanksgiving. We're going to drop a Thanksgiving episode on the Patreon page.
Apart from that, we just talked to Miss Betty Lynn Buckley and Norman Buckley.
He's great. I, as I told him, I was like, I feel like he's famous. I've known him for so
long. I think they, I mean, listen, both are, Betty has always been literal goddess, pedestal, Beltress, genius in every way, trailblazer, and now Norman. So her fame, I've always been like, and Norman has now succeeded at that fame for me as well, where I'm like, so.
Anyway.
Yes. Well, on that note, we absolutely love you, crime fam. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Killers, go to our Patreon page and join us to get exclusive bonus content and follow us on Instagram at Killing It On Broadway and Twitter at Killing It On B-Way.
Subscribe to us for free wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It On Broadway is a production of Killing It On Broadway, LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell. Orchestrations, Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.